Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, my co-host and artist for Smugbeat Games, Kenneth Ohm.
Hey there.
And our returning guest from Arkin Games, the owner and lead designer, Chris Park.
Hey, good to be here again.
Hey, Chris. How is everything going with you and the guys at Arkin?
It's going really good. We're on a roll at the moment, so that's always nice.
Yeah, it's been a few months since we last spoke to you. Hopefully you guys had a great summer. It's been just crazy hot over here.
Yeah, it's been a productive summer for us. We've finished a couple of projects and have another one that's coming along, so that's always pleasing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my first question is, I want to touch back with you on what we talked about on the last cast regarding Arkin's new development strategy going forward. And for people who missed that or don't remember, last time you spoke about how you were changing the development cycle behind Arkin before you guys were basically spending a lot of time making these massive games, a lot of details, a lot of time and money, and then, you know, hoping and praying that they would work. And we talked about how there were some troubles with A Valley Without Wind 1, and I think A Valley Without Wind 2 had a little bit of trouble, but I don't exactly remember that one. But what you talked about last time was changing it to focus on the smaller, more gameplay-focused designs, and then basically testing the waters. If they worked, great, you were going to expand on them and take them back to those massive epics like AI Wars and other successful projects. When we talked about Skyward Collapse, it was, I think, about a week or a little over a week when it was released, and you were happy with the numbers. Now that the dust has settled, it's been a few months, how is that strategy going at Arkin in terms of developing these smaller, more focused games?
I think it's definitely going well in terms of it being a valid thing to do. Mm-hmm. Skyward has remained a great financial success for us, and we've been able to do an expansion based off of that, and that's been well received with our players. You know, we're in kind of a dead period right now. August and September are just the worst months for game sales, period, unless you're doing like some sort of massive Steam sale or a Humble Bundle or something like that. So what we're seeing right now is like the expansion for Skyward Nihon Nomura is not really jumping off the shelves, which is unfortunate, but based on relative numbers to other Augusts, it's not, a grim sort of thing or anything like that. And Skyward's remained a, through like the Steam summer sale and all that sort of stuff, it remained doing well. So, I feel like we released Nihon at a bad time, but we actually knew that going in, and I wasn't real worried about the money in the upfront release of it. Expansions are funny, and so they're not reliant on the press in the same fashion that a base game is, because the reviews and all that are already in for the base game. And so at any rate, we released that in August kind of just to see. So we'd never released anything in August before, and we wanted to see if releasing something would make a difference versus just the normal baseline. Mm-hmm. And the answer is no. So now we know. Mm-hmm. I think that'll pay off well for us in the fall. And it's not like it didn't break even, or at least it's very close to breaking even, the expansion. So, you can't ask for a whole lot more than that, but it's... Well, you can, but baseline breaking even's not bad. Mm-hmm. So, from that perspective, things have been doing real well.
Cool. And I just saw a few weeks ago that Arkin's been steadily adding the Steam cards to their games. I know Skyward has them. I think A Valley Without Wind 2 has them as well at this point, or am I
Just A Valley Without Wind 1. We are working on Valley Without Wind 2 and Shattered Haven and AI War and so forth, having the Steam cards, but it's just kind of a as we have time to get to them sort of thing. Happened to have a lot of concept art for Valley 1, and so that made that particularly easy.
And we were talking about this before the cast, but what are your general thoughts on the whole Steam card involvement now that's been released? We've had the whole big summer sale with them. How is it from your perspective?
I think it's neutral to positive from my perspective. Mm-hmm. At first, we were like, steam cars. I mean, you know, what is this? You know, when they first told us about it. And so we're like, well, we'll wait and see what it is. And then, you know, I almost feel like we missed an opportunity right there at the start when they mm-hmm. first came out, because the developers who were first out on that were, you know, really reaping some, you know, financial benefits out of that. Mm-hmm. I feel like the financial benefits beyond that aren't really there in abundance, in the sense of, you know, it's going to like double your bottom line or mm-hmm. add 10% or, you know, some sort of giant numbers. But that said, it's kind of like Steam achievements or mm-hmm. Some of the other features along those lines. Those things do matter, and there are people who really enjoy them. And when it's your game versus some other stuff that the player may be considering, the customer might be considering anyway, they're not a player yet, you know, mm-hmm. they're trying to decide what to buy. I think that it's not necessarily a deciding factor. I mean, they want to get the game they want to get, but it's certainly a minor inducement. It's like, hey, it comes with these other things that I also want. I mean, you know, win all around. I get Steam cards, I get achievements, I get mm-hmm. the game that I want as well. Hey, all right, let's do it, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's neutral to positive for me.
Yeah, I think what's going to really set the Steam cards, whether it be a massive success or just an okay success, would be what they're planning on doing next in terms of what will these cards actually give the player, what actual value they will have. As you talked about, when games have, you know, TF2 hats and achievements, those things have a pretty established value. I know Ken has talked about in the past about how much the TF2 hats can have an effect on his purchases, especially if the game is already on sale. It's, you know, a $4 or $5 game, and they throw, you know, TF2 hats on top of that. That's a game that if you like to play, that's just, you know, gravy or, you know, the icing on the cake.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think that's one of the things. If somebody's like, well, do I buy this now or do I buy this a little bit later? And they're kind of fence-sitting for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, all of our gaming budgets are limited, as, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of, and not just financial budget, but like time budget. Mm-hmm. And so if they're sitting on the fence, then that sort of thing, you know, any little icings on the cake are a good mm-hmm. thing.
mm-hmm. Yep. And now one question that I have, just in a, I guess, a design-related question or a business-related perspective, is one thing that we've been seeing a lot with the early access and just in terms of Steam sales is the issue of, I guess, trying to put a value on early access games or, I guess, quote-unquote, pre-ordering an alpha game. And I was just wondering, what are your thoughts as a designer on this whole idea that there have been debates about whether or not it's all right for developers to release the alpha or release a paid alpha versus people who they should just, you know, wait for the game to be released or wait for beta and then take the money?
Well, like with anything, it's kind of a case-by-case basis. Mm-hmm. If this is a brand new developer who has no track record whatsoever and you're not really sure that they can actually pull off what they're promising, whatever that is, that's a case where I would be wary of pre-ordering. And I mean, you see mm-hmm. that with Kickstarter sometimes yeah. where the result doesn't materialize. But that said, even with those sort of things, if the people are, you know, competent and are able to demonstrate that in some fashion, whether or not they have a track record, it's something that can be demonstrated. It's like, hey, look, I know what I'm doing. This is my first time, but I know what I'm doing well enough to do this. And if somebody's demonstrating that, then okay. In terms of the generalized thing of, is it ethical or whatever to do a pre-release product? I mean, I think that's a silly sort of a question for anybody mm-hmm. to really ask, because if two people want to make a transaction, you know, mm-hmm. one person wants early access to something, one person wants some funding to help finish making something. If those two people both feel like this is an acceptable thing to do, what does any third party have to say mm-hmm. about that? I mean, if you don't like alpha stuff, don't buy alpha stuff. Mm-hmm. If you buy alpha stuff thinking it's like a finished product, but, you know, mm-hmm. but not done, that's a weird thing to think. That's really not a good way to approach it, and you've got only yourself to blame. You know, and on the same flip side, if the developers are putting out something that's just way more broken than it should be, and they're not doing anything to address it, alpha or not, then that's an issue. But my view is that the early access and the alpha access and all that sort of thing, helps make games better. Mm-hmm. And it's when the game is still in a, you know, players always want to have input, right? They want to have input on the way games are. This is how you get input. When a game is still being made, if you give feedback and the developers aren't being stupid, you can change things if there's something wrong with the game. If the game is already done, that is not a given, you know. If it's that's really not a given. So even from just a regular player's point of view, who's not somebody who just can't wait until it comes out, being able to be in early, I mean, that is something I would have loved as a kid. I mean, that would have just been amazing. I can't, you know, that just would have been great. So, you know, it's not for everybody. But decrying the practice is something that I think is silly. You know, it's not like, you know, you could make the same sort of arguments on the surface about like free to play of, oh, well, if the two of them want to make the transaction, then it's okay. You know, he wants to spend $1,000 on Smurf coins or whatever. And so, you know, what does a third party have to say? I mean, you could say those same sort of words there. But in that sort of case, I don't really agree, because you're preying on somebody's, you know.
Yeah, like their addictive qualities or addictive personality.
Exactly. You're preying on parts of their personality that they can't control, and you're giving them something not very valuable by anybody's stretch of the imagination in return. You're giving them something that you could give for free that has no real tangible value. But with an early access game, they're getting something tangible. They're getting something they want early, and they get to keep it forever, and they don't have to keep paying, and they wind up getting the final thing too. So, I mean, you know, I don't think that cross applies. Sometimes the, well, if these two people want to do it, what does anybody else have to say is not really the real argument. But here I think it does work.
And as a quick side note regarding the whole free-to-play, whether it's okay to prey on people, I know that I spoke with Chris Gardner and Joe McDonough over the last few weeks, who are working on free-to-play browser-based games, and they're having that same issue of trying to define value, and the fact that so many free-to-play or otherwise social games are preying on those people, it really dilutes the value from their games when they're not trying to do that. Because if you get burned once on a game, why should you go try someone else's game and give them the chance to screw you as well?
Right. And it's a tricky sort of a model. And there are some people that do it right. I mean, like, and there are people who do it wrong the other way and are too generous, you know, because that's a problem too. Like Punch Quest on iOS, those guys were trying to be so friendly with the free-to-play that they wind up like shooting themselves in the foot, where like nobody ever needed to buy anything. And that's, you know, the developers do need to get paid if stuff is going to continue to be being made. But then there's ones like, you know, Nimble Quest and a lot of the other stuff that Nimblebit does on iOS that are done very well. They're balanced really well. You know, I've played Nimble Quest and, you know, played it for free some, and then kicked them over a few bucks for various stuff and didn't feel bad about it. And, you know, that works out fine. Triple Town is another good example of one that was fine. But it's just, it is a real tough thing. And when I see that something is free to play that I was interested in, then I'm immediately like, well, maybe I'm not interested after all.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it often is a mask for lazy design as well. It's not always by any stretch, but it can be. Balanced, no problem. Have them pay to get past it, you know?
Yeah, and that's the whole issue. When you have developers trying to use that model to expand their games, when you had 50, 100 other smaller games just trying to rip as many people off, you know, get the money and run, it's very hard to keep that model going. And
right.
It will be interesting to see in the next few years, even in the next year, if free-to-play will continue with this model, or will there have to be some new formal adoption of it?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I have a feeling that free-to-play is not going to go away, but I think that it will become a lot less trendy than it is now. And once it becomes less trendy, then it can settle into its natural state without the predators being around so much. I mean, that tends to happen. So, you know, it's just not very mature yet in terms of a practice, which is fine. I mean, that's just the life cycle it's in, but... you know, and it's one of those things that's not for me as a developer. I doubt I'll ever do it, but, you know, and as a player, I generally don't like it, but on some occasions when the developer does it just right, then I'm cool with it. So,
Yep. And speaking about trendy or what's popular right now, I have one last question before we move on and talk about Skyward. And that is, from a developer perspective, I just want to get your thoughts on Kickstarter and crowdfunding. I don't think I asked this on previous casts, but I've been talking to previous guests, and we've been getting to discussions regarding the merits and the problems of Kickstarter. And I just want to get your thoughts as both a designer and someone who has been making games from before and after crowdfunding has really taken a huge surge. What are your thoughts on the platform?
I think it's a great option to have. Prior to Kickstarter existing, you know, if you didn't have any money, you either had to take out a personal loan or do something else like super risky or just be rich or something. Or you had to muddle by with whatever talent you individually possessed or whatever free talent you could drum up by badgering other people. And that only works out so well and only works out for some people. And, you know, initially that's what I did for AI War and it worked out for me, but I, you know, that's a risky sort of thing. It doesn't work out for most developers. And, you know, it's just kind of a luck thing in my case, not any special situation on my part there. Kickstarter changes that equation to where you actually have a new option. It's a powerful one. That said, if you have any other option whatsoever, I wouldn't do it. Because, I mean, to me, that's like the safety net. You know, if you need money and you can't get it some other way, do a Kickstarter. It's great. If you have some other way of doing it, it's kind of like if you need a loan, then great. It's great to be able to get a loan. But if you have money, don't get a loan. Are you crazy? You know, you're going to pay interest. You know, why would you take out a loan and pay interest if you can avoid taking out the loan? Because there is interest. And the interest when it comes to Kickstarter is, you know, it's a myriad of things. I mean, the cut that they take is certainly one. The all of the order fulfillment stuff that you have to do with all of the kind of side I forget what they're even called now, so I'm blanking.
Stretch goals?
Well, yeah. There's the stretch goals, which, I mean, assumedly, if they're related to your game, then that's great. But the little prizes that you get on the sidebar, for the backer rewards.
Okay.
You know, a lot of those are like, you know, t-shirts or, you know, these other things that are unrelated that you're probably not good at producing necessarily, and that probably can't be produced at cheap cost, and those things eat into your Kickstarter profit margin and, you know, just all this stuff. Then you have the whole expectations thing, which, you know, players who have not been able to play whatever it is you're making, certainly at least not the final version, they're excited enough that they've spent whatever money on it, possibly major money, like way more than they would spend on the game normally. You know, with the alpha funding model, you spend sometimes less than the game would cost at 1.0, sometimes a little more, like, you know, I think Prison Architect and some of the others, I think they're planning on coming down with the price when they hit 1.0. But with a Kickstarter, some of these people are spending like $200, $300, $400 or more. And that's fine if that's something they really want to see get created. But then if it's not exactly what they want when it's done, oh boy. If you spend $500 on something and it's not just what you want, man, that's not a good feeling, right? And it's really hard to extract the exact idea from somebody else's head and put it in your own. Plus, you don't know what troubles the developers are going to run into because if you're not done coding the game, there's always something unexpected that happens. And so whatever those unexpected twists and turns are, you know, the players, the backers, they may or may not agree with the decisions that come out of that. So there's always going to be some unhappy people who spent a lot of money and now regret it. And so again, that comes back to where, you know, I'd rather, if you can avoid that fallout, then it's good to do so. You know, you're able to stay much more focused and so on. But boy, is Kickstarter nice as an option to have, specifically if you have no other better options, which most starting developers don't. So if you're a starting developer, great. If you're not a starting developer, try and fund your next work with your prior work if you can.
Well, you know, it all kind of correlates to each other, the free-to-play stuff that we talked about earlier and Kickstarter, where I think we're, again, we're having a closer connection between you know, the developers and your audience. And I think really people are really enjoying being part of the process.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Kickstarter is so cool. And I mean, there's some dangers to it, right? Sometimes you get yourself a little too close to the project and then, you know, get kind of attached and vice versa, where sometimes you get a little too personal with your audience and then you can't meet their crazy demands. And that's always a big worry with people with Kickstarter projects.
And that's also where it kind of comes into, like with the alpha funding stuff. I mean, you know, if people buy an alpha product thinking it's going to be like a finished product and then are disappointed, they only have themselves to blame. And if they back a project that is early on in the stages of being kickstarted and you know what the status of that project is and it's not like it's coming out next month, then, you know, there's some inherent risk in there that either A, it might not get finished, or B, it might not be quite what you want. And if you still want to be part of the process anyway, and you believe in the developer, and most importantly, you are, you know, that supportive of whatever it is they want to do, then that's a great way to be part of it, because that gives players, like you were saying, I mean, the player involvement, for players who are complaining that whatever it is that they like, flight sims, let's say, are being ignored by the major developers, you know, they're able to demonstrate, hi, I would like a flight simulator. You started this guy who's starting a flight simulator. It looks like he can do it. Fine, I'm going to throw a bunch of money his way and show the industry I want flight simulators, and more specifically, I want his one because it looks great. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from that perspective, absolutely, I agree that player involvement, I mean, it's a great thing. I mean, there's no one right way to do this, you know, and there's right ways and wrong ways to do all these things in the whole shades of most right to least right, you know, and it's always so situational. I think it's a great thing to have options, and Kickstarter's opens a bunch of new options. So I'm super happy it exists. Let's put it that way. I don't have any intention of using it, unless I really screw up something else, but, I sure love that it exists.
I love it. I think, it can also be a big ego buster, because I have a friend of mine, did a Kickstarter and he had no supporters at all, which is pretty terrible after you do like 3 months of preparation, right? Because you never know what's going to hit. So like, he's just like super depressed now and it feels like he's just worthless. So right now he's getting out of that kind of rut. But I mean, the idea was sound. He had a problem with, his video wasn't very compelling. So.
Yeah, that's, and it's always kind of a little bit of a luck of the draw. Not always the most worthy projects rise to the front on anything. I mean, on Steam, on the App Store, on Kickstarter, on the press, whatever, not always the most worthy stuff gets noticed. I mean, it's just life, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, it stinks when it's you that it's happening to in particular, but I mean, the knowledge that that happens is at least some salve that, well, it's not that I just completely suck. You know, it's sometimes it's not anything that the person could have done. It's just their bad luck.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, again, all these options are really fantastic. The Kickstarter projects, the buy-in betas and stuff are really leaving the options open. Did you watch the Res Talk with the guys from Prison Architect?
No, I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, it's really cool. The guy from Prison Architect, they have my favorite from Dreamfall, the creator, mm-hmm. and I think also Avalon from Obsidian, right? No? Yes?
Chris Avalon?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, okay. I think Obsidian.
Yep, and he was there too, and they're all having their talks about their experience with Kickstarter, their experience with buying betas, why Prison Architect was set at such a high price, et cetera, so it's pretty cool. You should check out that talk.
Cool.
Before we move on, Ken, do you have any other questions regarding industry or game-related stuff?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay, so let's move on and talk a little bit about Skyward Collapse. So, obviously, the two big pieces of news is the Skyward Collapse version 2.0 update and the expansion, which I am not going to attempt to try to pronounce the name because I know I'm just going to horrifically butcher it. I'm glad that you pronounced it earlier, Chris.
Yeah, it's very phonetic on there, so it's just Nihon Numura. It literally means Japanese village, so in Japanese.
Cool. So let's first start with the 2.0 upgrade. So last week I got the email from Eric, who is Arkin's PR guy and your administrator, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the last time I actually played Skyward Collapse was, I think, version 1.06, 1.07, it was right after the discussion about if you could place mountains or not, which I know that was a very interesting time.
Right.
So I got the game. I was like, okay, you know, I played it. I was pretty good. I can just get right back into the groove. I load it up and I'm like, what the heck happened? Where are all these new icons? Why can't I build myth units? So for the people like me who are either returning to Skyward or new fans who are picking the game up, walk us through a little bit about what is Skyward Collapse version 2.0?
That's a big question. there's about 500 some odd changes between 1.0 and 2.0. So that's hard to sum up at all briefly. Okay. With some of the things, mostly there's a lot of new stuff. There's not a whole lot of rules that have changed that would impact returning players. In terms of the myth units thing, you know, you need soul imprints now, and you know it shows you that in the tooltip if you hover. You know, then if you look on your right hand bar, you know, it says, you know, you can see the little soul prints icon there, and it tells you how to get them. This is whenever a human dies. So I mean, most of that stuff should be fairly self-explanatory after you have that initial shock. But then there's that shock of, wow, this thing is different, because all the myth units that you're facing and all the bandits in general that you're facing, both their human and their myth unit forms, they had been using like the faction types before, and now they're completely their own thing. And so like your example of the mountains issue, how we solved that was, fine, you can place mountains all you want, but now the bandits have these driller guys that can drill through the mountains and make it so they can pass them. Now, of course, that makes it part of the game, which I was really pleased with this solution, because rather than saying, you can't do this, we'll make it into a game. If you can kill the driller guys before they get your mountains, you keep your mountains. Or if they get your mountains, then you can build a second layer of mountains to, like, you know, reinforce your walls again. So it becomes part of the game rather than either an exploit or something we're banning, which I, you know, that's why I was so pleased with that solution, is it makes something the players naturally want to do into something that's neither an exploit nor just barred, something that they're leashed away from being able to do. You know, and that gets into then some more things like, well, okay, the guys that drill in, they leave these mountain tunnels that you can't replace normally, but then there's these new abilities that also play off of the souls that you collect. So one of those is Bless, which lets you turn like a mountain cave back into a mountain, or a bridged lake back into a regular lake, or a blight into a regular like grassland, or it also lets you like restore some of the ruins and stuff. And so there's all this new like flexibility there with the souls stuff, and you know, they gate the military, the mythological guys a little bit, so you can't just completely ignore the humans and just do mythological. Players do some funny things. It's always always the cleverness. I love the cleverness, but it's one of those things where you have a strategy game in particular. You know, if you're continuously designing it after, or refining it really, after players get their hands on it for a while, you keep running into these outlier clever players who do weird stuff that you're like, oh man, nobody's thought of this. You know, you're like the 10,000th player. Nobody's thought of this until you, and you've totally broken the game. And so then it's like, all right, what do we do to resolve this without like completely flipping out all the other players who are playing more normally? You know, and so there's always challenges there. And we went through that whole process with Skyward between 1.0 and 2.0, and, you know, hence some of the changes. But, you know, the late game we discovered was kind of dragging and not being as interesting as we wanted it to be in Skyward 1.0. I mean, it wasn't apparent for a while that that's what was happening, but, you know, it was happening more often than we wanted it to, is really what it boiled down to. And so then we shifted it so that it would be, there would be new monsters that were showing up in the Third Age that were really very tough, and so they would kind of throw the balance off some. And we added some other mechanics that start showing up in the Third Age so that it doesn't drag at the end. It stays interesting to the end. And of course, there's always, I like to call them safety valves, where there's always a remainder. There's always somebody who is an outlier, and no matter how interesting you, for instance, make the late game, they're going to be bored by it. They're going to be so good that they just meet all the goals, right? Mm-hmm. Early in the third age, and then they're just like clicking through the turns to get to the end. Well, that's boring. So here's where the safety valve comes in to deal with the remainder. No matter how small the remainder is, it's nice to have a safety valve to deal with it. And so in our case, we added this Armageddon token, where if you have 200 souls, you can cause Armageddon to happen, and just like all heck breaks loose. And there's bandits everywhere and monsters, and they're just covering the board and stuff for 10 turns. And if you can survive that 10 turns, then the game ends then, rather than you having to wait all the way to the end. And not only does the game end, but you get a big score bonus thing there. And so so that Armageddon thing becomes the safety valve where, you know, the end can't drag, because if the end is starting to drag, just cause Armageddon. That's not going to drag for you. You know, if you can survive that, it's exciting and you're done. You know, and so there's a lot of things along those sort of lines, and just increasing the variety and so forth. And with the player, like human units and so forth, kind of differentiating them a little bit more and splitting out a couple so that they come from like these new ally camps that you don't directly control, but which come up and unbalance things in another different way. And in a good, you know, for those not, who don't know, you know, my job as a developer is to unbalance things in Skyward Collapse as much as possible so that the players have to balance it. And that's hence the crux of Skyward. It's like a reverse strategy game. Normally the developer balances it, and in this case the player balances it. So that's and we did some graphical upgrades too. We added some particle effects, did a better font, did a few other things, and that's in a pretty, you know, 10,000-foot overview, that's pretty much 2.0.
Okay, cool. Now, going back, you were saying a few minutes ago regarding the outlier player, some of these crazy strategies. My strategy that I came up with in the original version was during the first turn when you get 10 free actions or 10 free buildings you could put down, was I always put down the Sunstone, I think that's what it's called, building first, so that way I would get that extra resource so I could get Myth units out earlier. But of course, now that you added the Soul Imprint, that just completely upset my strategy. And I think it's interesting, as you say, especially with strategy games, is that once someone has latched onto a particular strategy or a particular unit or combo that works every time, they're going to do it every time, because why should they not do it? And it's very interesting with Skyward Collapse, as you said, that your job is to sort of break the game to prevent these strategies and then let the player sort of pick up the pieces and let them try to put everything back together again.
Yeah, and my goal with any strategy game that we create, I mean, AI War's been a different goal, been the same goal, but from a different way of accomplishing it, because with AI War, it's more traditional, where we try and balance it, but in that case, make sure that there's no one best strategy that people always fall into using. Mm-hmm. With Skyward, we're trying to unbalance it and make sure there's no one best strategy for them to rebalance it. And with both of those, you know, that involves a lot of feedback from players and so forth and seeing what sort of the outliers are. But it really comes down to, if somebody finds one thing that always works in a strategy game, that's the kiss of death. Because, I mean, that's the end of them playing that game. They may have bought it, I have their money, fine, but I don't feel real good about it if they're not going to get more out of it than that. And so by making sure, not to take the Nerf bat to them or something like that either, where it's like, you can't play the way you want, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's more a matter of saying, okay, well, this is still valid. You can still play a Myth unit game, but it's not going to dominate, and you can't just, you can't just do that and nothing else. And the big thing is making it so that the player has to react to the situation. That's a big part of where procedural generation and strategy games for me intersect, is you have to look at the current situation, and it's a situation you haven't quite seen before, and you have to tailor a solution to that situation. You don't just reach, you know, into your pocket and pull out the same thing you did for every other situation you saw. That's not a strategy game. You know, that's just moving stuff around on a board.
Yeah.
You know, the strategy game is actually sizing up a situation and doing something different, and, you know, knowing which tool to use for which job. And so, you know, Skyward Collapse 1.0 did that reasonably well. But there's a really big difference between having a couple of hundred players give you feedback and between having, you know, 10,000 plus players you know, running through and the outliers giving you feedback. It's not like we had 10,000 people's worth of feedback, but the people that do something funky and break it, those ones are quick to come. And when you have a larger pool.
Now, going back to what you said regarding how it's your job to unbound Skyward, with Skyward Collapse in an overall design sense, do you have a baseline or a foundation that you want to keep the game or adhere the bounds to? Or is it like anything goes as long as the player has the way to sort of quote-unquote fix it?
Really, we try and think of as many different things as possible. And so that's actually kind of true in AI War as well. In it, the way that I like to refer to it is exploring the decision space. Mm-hmm. That sounds weird and pretentious, I guess. But essentially, there's a certain kind of decisions that players get to make in a strategy game. And there's a certain manner of thinking. In Skyward Collapse, you're trying to balance something that is unbalanced, and there are certain rules, the baseline rule set. And exploring the decision space means giving as many possible riffs off of the core mechanics as possible and just messing with every possible permutation we can ever think of. With AI War, it's the same sort of thing. The premise is different, and they're supposed to be fighting a war and unbalancing it in your favor, like any strategy game. You want to win, ergo you want to shift the balance so that you are big and your opponent is small, you know. And there's certain rules in terms of how you go about doing that, and we explore the decision space there by giving them different tools and creating different obstacles and creating, you know, just all this myriad of new content. Mm-hmm. And so we explore two different decision spaces with these two different strategy games, and within the bounds of that sort of universe, I mean, it's like we're not going to introduce Thor in AI War. It's not like anything goes. Mm-hmm. But in terms of mechanically speaking, we like to have a baseline set of rules and then think of how we can break those rules. Like, okay, well, normally guys can't cross mountains, so let's break that rule. These guys can cross mountains, you know, blah, blah. You know, you keep going on. And it's just we look at all the rules and think of all the kind of diffs we can come up with of those.
Okay. Now, going back to the discussion we just had regarding the mountains and how you worked around placing them in and altering that kind of design. One question that I have in terms of just your overall design philosophy is, especially with Skyward Collapse, we saw how the game has gone through a lot of changes from 1.0 to 2.0. And I know that a lot of things were reworked or removed or changed, such as trading, which is now the currency resource. So, as a designer, how do you know when it's time to, I guess, quote-unquote, kill your babies, or when mechanic or system just doesn't work, you can't figure out, and you're like, okay, you know, I'm done with this, let's move on and try something else and see if that will work?
Well, usually that's more of an artistic question than a concrete sort of scientific question, you know what I mean? And so it's just kind of, you know it when you see it, I guess. That's a lame answer, but generally there's a sense of discomfort that goes along with that, where you're like, this just does not feel right. We've tried some things, you know, we can visualize a number of potential solutions and none of those feel right. There's nothing else we can think of. There's nothing else anybody else has suggested. Can we think of anything better? And so then you start thinking about, you know, what are the potential other things you could do that might solve the need that you have there or solve a similar need in a better way that does not prey to all these issues. So then once you come up with a better idea, then it's like, okay, you know, it's this idea versus the problems that we had before. And you come out with saying, okay, you know, let's make the jump. Mm-hmm. You know, this one's good. This one's uncomfortable. It's time to move. And so you wind up doing it. And, you know, it's all very much by feel at that point, but also by player feedback. You get people constantly saying, you know, I just don't use a trading post because it seems superfluous, or I find it unfun. It's a little fiddly, whatever. It just doesn't feel right, you know. And the players say, you know, we don't use that. We didn't use the flowers tile. So it's like, okay, well, what can we do with the flowers tile that would be more useful? Yeah. You know, you find out what the usage patterns are and you react to that. So it's a matter of taking in the data and deciding what to do with that data.
Speaking about that data, Do you use any, do you get that data from like Steam Metrics, or do you get that from like just fan responses on the forums?
We get that from fan responses on the forums. We also have a idea tracker, is what we call it. This is the Mantis bug tracker, and we have in 4 years we have collected north of 12,000 suggestions in there, and we actually had another 5,000 suggestions on the forums prior to switching to the Mantis tool. So we collect quite a bit of feedback, and it's mostly very, very useful. I won't say all, but in the main, it's very, very useful. And often the solution isn't exactly what the players suggest, although sometimes, probably a good 60% of the time it is, they're really on the ball. But even if they don't have the exact solution in mind, players are ace at identifying problems. Yeah. And so, you know, and a good number of them are great at identifying solutions. Some identify solutions to problems that other people came up with. You know, person A says, oh, this is a problem. You know, and player B says, aha, I hadn't even really thought about it, but you're totally right. That's a problem. What if we did X? And the developer's like, wow, you're right. So, you know, some of the changes come from there, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know I've been using it with Skyler, and I did with Shatterhaven. I put up a few ideas. I think you made some corrections from some of the stuff that I put up.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. That's right.
All
right.
Our next question will be a great lead into the expansion. As we talked about in terms of Skyler Collapse, you were focusing on creating a smaller, more focused game and then expanding on it further through expansions. From a design or just overall thought process, when you're thinking up new content or new expansions, do you think, like, I would say, I'm not sure how I would put this, but do you think in terms, like, do you think of everything at one time? Like, are you, like, do you have, like, somewhere a big book that says, you know, Skyler Collapse Expansion 4, stuff like that? Or is it more of an organic feel for you? Like, is it, I guess that would be my question.
When it comes to a big new thing like that, we handle this in two parts. Well, really three parts, let's put it this way. There's some stuff that's kind of a given. We're going to give some new features in X category. So there's going to be new music. Okay, let's work on that. There's going to be some new maps. There's going to be a new faction. What are they going to be like? So there's these givens. Then there's what we call anchor features, which are some giant new thing that is going to be in there. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, that was the Hamlets in the first expansion. And so, you're like, okay, you know, we know the Hamlets are going to be in there. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much all we have to know to get started. And you're like, you know, okay, well, we're going to do Japanese. That's going to be our faction. We're going to do music. We're going to do the Hamlets is our anchor feature, and then there will be some other miscellanea. And that stuff, the miscellanea, develops organically. And of course, with like the anchor feature and even with the main, you know, civilization and other kind of the givens, those things, we start with an idea and then we do a bunch of prototyping and, you know, see what works and, you know, go from there. The prototyping is a lot less intense with an expansion for an existing game than doing a completely new game, because you already know so much about that world and how things work that you don't have to, there's just so much that you don't have to question. You can take certain things as constants because you're not making a new game, you're making new stuff for an existing game. So, okay.
All right. So, as we just said with the expansion, there's been, I would say, three major new systems. We have the Japanese faction, the Hamlet system, and of course, the new cultural victory with the arc, Luminous arc.
Luminous.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess my first question is, as we looked at with Skyler Collapse, you already had the Norse and the Greek sides and their mythological units. What made you decide to use Japan and Japanese mythology as the basis for the first expansion?
Well, we had a lot of suggestions from players that wanted a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things is picking a mythology that's large enough, that has enough stuff going on in it to really do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, picking a lot of the like Western religions, for instance, there's a little bit of an iffiness, like, mm-hmm. you know, placing Jesus or something like that in there. But I mean, there's just not a lot of characters. I mean, if you get into like saints or something, then there's stuff and there's demons and all that in, mm-hmm. in a lot of like Catholicism. But there's, you know, with like the Greeks or the Norse or the Japanese or the Egyptians, there's like a million mythological characters in there. Mm-hmm. And the Egyptians were the other ones that we really considered really strongly, and they're probably what we'll do for the second expansion if we do one. And the Japanese won out over the Egyptians just because it felt like those were the less obvious choice, and therefore would be more interesting.
Okay. Now, with the Hamlet system, this is a pretty interesting system because it sort of is a size system in the way that the player doesn't really need to use it too much if they just focus on the main combat. So how was it developing what would be, it's more, I guess, it's a peaceful system, but it's peaceful in the way that it's created through violence because you can only create hamlets via the destroyed tiles on the map.
Right. So, I mean, that was something I'd really wanted to do because it gets more to the city builder aspect of the game rather than the strategic part of the game. And that is almost a little bit more like a puzzle game in some respects because it's got so much to do with proximity in terms of how you place your buildings and how you score culture off of that. And if you're playing the main military game, you're right, you absolutely can completely ignore those if you want to, but there's some wicked cool things you can get that you really want for your military, which are like large towns. You can get towns that are twice as big, which can be really useful. And then there's some other cultural abilities that you can get that let you do some powerful abilities on the board. And so, you know, you can completely ignore the cultural victory and still getting some culture is useful for doing these other abilities. I mean, one lets you roll back time so that it doesn't take you back in time in the sense that the board goes back, but it gives you more time, another 10 turns, so that if you are about to miss your score goal and lose, you can go back 10 turns and keep going. And so with some of those sorts of things, those are really good ways to kind of have an ace in the hole, basically.
Yeah, sort of like an emergency situation or something you can have in case, but it's not something that you have to, you know, focus on getting, but it's something that's nice to have.
Right. In the large towns, I mean, you can build a whole strategy around large towns, so that becomes, you know, one military strategy that you can use if you want to have big towns that don't get destroyed as often. You know, you can pursue that now, and so it opens up new ways of playing, but they're not required. And so that's one of the things that I like is when it gives the players freedom to... I feel like games feel the most real when there are a lot of options for the players and they can kind of express themselves in there. If things are too on rails, then at best you're kind of getting a movie or a story, and at worst it's not really a game.
So what was the decision to have the cultural victory with the Luminous Arc and have that implemented into Skyward Collapse?
Well, players have been asking from the start for having alternate victory conditions. I mean, if you think about like Civilization or something, I mean, that's always something that's really fun. And so I knew that I wanted a dual purpose for the Hamlets, you know, because if it's city building and it's peaceful and it does not contribute to the war effort, then it's pointless. And so having it so that it just contributes into the war effort, well, that's only so interesting. Having it so that you can contribute to the war effort in exciting ways and so that you can focus on it to its own end and win without, you know, and really minimizing the war effort in the process, if you so choose, that to me was really exciting. And so, you know, I really like the way of having alternate ways to win that really aren't, you know, what you're used to. It really makes it feel fresh.
Definitely. Okay. So I think my last question for the Skyward Collapse before we move on to Bionic Dues is, as we talked about, if you guys plan a second expansion, you're going to use Egyptian, possibly, as the next civilization. So my question is, have you at all thought about, I would say, quote-unquote, the long game? Or, like, let's say, you know, distant future, we're talking about Skyward Collapse version 7.0 or 8.0 or something like that. Are there any concepts that are, like, in the back of your mind that you would love to have in Skyward, but at this point in time, it would just be too much of a revolution to put them into the game?
Unfortunately, not really. That's one thing that's probably meaning that it's not going to see like six expansions or something, because I just don't think the game is as a, like with Tidalis, for instance. Mm-hmm. I mean, that didn't sell well, but it was such a complete game in and of itself. There was just nothing more to do. Mm-hmm. We're not at that point with Skyward. There's still more things that we can do that are interesting. And if you haven't played it yet, that doesn't mean you shouldn't play mm-hmm. it, because, you know, that's almost a recommendation. Like, this is a complete thing. This is exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, but with it, there's going to come a point prior to having six expansions where there's just not much more for us to do that wouldn't be getting repetitive. Mm-hmm. And I don't like getting repetitive. So we do have a number of new ideas that we're excited about at this point. And so there's, you know, at least one more expansion that we can do if, you know, player interest is there and all that we'll probably do in quarter one or quarter two of 2014. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I never thought that we'd be on expansion 6 of AI War. So, you know, mm-hmm. I guess it goes to show you never know. Yes. We kept coming up with ideas long after I thought we were gonna. And we had a number of revolutions in the mechanics there. But, you know, usually those things can't be foreseen, because if there was something that was that revolutionary, we'd probably go on and do it.
And speaking about going between AI Wars, Skyward Collapse, and working on new projects, I was just wondering, do you have a preference for either working on brand new properties or going back to like AI Wars or something else and expanding on that content? I guess what's easier for you, or it doesn't really matter?
Well, you know, they each have their challenges. Mm-hmm. When you're doing something new in an existing place, you have to be careful not to mess that place up. Mm-hmm. And you have to be careful that you're not just getting repetitive, that you actually have something new to say there. Mm-hmm. So there's a challenge in that. You know, you want the expansions to be good expansions and players to get a good value and them to be excited about it. And so that's, like I said, those are the challenges there. On the other hand, there are a lot of prototyping things that you don't have to do just because that's mm-hmm. not an unfamiliar environment to you. Okay. And then, you know, with a new property, you have no expectations that you have to meet in terms of what the world is going to be like or whatever. And so you're a lot freer in certain ways, but also you don't have the path mapped out. And so the prototyping is long and difficult by comparison. And, you know, I like doing both. I like kind of going back and forth between. That's one of my favorite things about this job, is being able to do lots of different things. Mm-hmm. And so it can be, you know, at the moment, I'm really happy to be moving away from Skyward Collapse, because I've been on that so intensely for a while. Mm-hmm. But I know that in a few months, I'm going to be like, I want to do more on Skyward Collapse. So, I mean, mm-hmm. it's one of those things where you just kind of go back and forth between what you're working on. And I like that.
Okay. All right. So let's move on and talk about the future of Ark and about Bionic Dudes. Now, I know last time you were talking about Bionic Dudes, and I think you mentioned Ghosts in the Machine. I think that game has been put on hiatus, right?
Or Exodus the Machine. Yeah, that one's been put on hiatus. So.
Okay. So with Bionic Dudes, can you talk a little bit about what exactly the game is?
It's basically a roguelite with some tactical influences. So it, unlike a lot of roguelites, it has a meta layer where you play in a city and you're trying to achieve this goal. And that's basically to stop this robot army that's building and is going to come attack you. So you're trying to weaken the army and trying to strengthen yourself while you prepare for 50 days. And you can actually attack them and shrink the number of days, too. And there's pros and cons to doing that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how you express what you're doing is all through the mission selection. And then you actually play through the missions. And each mission is kind of like a floor in a roguelike. Okay. And so... But it's like you get to choose your floors. Not only do you get to choose what order you do them in, but you get to choose what the floor types are. And there's different rewards from each type of floor, each type of mission. And they have an overall impact on the strategic layer. You can lose. You can die, and it's not a death is permanent thing. It's not permadeath, per se. Mm-hmm. So it's one reason it's a rogue light instead of a rogue like. Mm-hmm. But there is a loss state that you get to, where each time you fail a mission, your HQ gets attacked and takes damage, and depending on your difficulty level, it has a certain number of missions you can fail before you, that's it, you're done. Mm-hmm. And as you progress through, you know, the bulk of the gameplay is more like a roguelike, and it has a lot of emphasis on, well, all the combat is ranged, and therefore, as part of that, there is an emphasis on maneuver and positioning. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things where you have weapons with like a spread pattern and you want to line up the enemies in that spread pattern and get them, or there's too many enemies around to bend, and so you see them on sensors, and then you make your little robot whistle, and they're like, what's that? And they come looking for you, and you shoot them when they come around the corner, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got like stealth and mines, you can affect them with viruses, and there's hacking that you can do on like doors and treasure chests and stuff to get, and, you know, these computers that you can use to like, inflict buffs or debuffs. You're kind of like the potions in a regular roguelike. There's all this stuff that you can explore and that contribute to the sense of tactics and, you know, general being a roguelike. Mm-hmm. And then instead of getting regular like equipment that you directly, you know, you don't get like a +5 sword of Fargol or whatever. You get, instead you get parts. And this is something that's really cool. You've got 4 exos, which are basically like mechs. And each one of them has a bunch of different slots, and they have a different type. So it's kind of like Final Fantasy I, where you can select like 2 fighters and a black mage and a white mage, mm-hmm. or whatever. Here you've got 6 different types you can select from, which are Assault, Siege, Brawler, Science, Tank. Well, sorry, it's Ninja now. We just changed that. And shoot, there's another one that I forgot. I forget which ones I said. Sniper. I didn't think I said Sniper. But anyway, so you get to select from those. They all have different like slots available. They have different weapons. They have different abilities in terms of like some built-ins. And you collect these parts and you put them into your weapons, into your reactor, into your computer system, into your propulsion, and into your shields. Mm-hmm. And these parts are like, there's like a +5 mysterious coolant tank of doom or something like that yesterday. It was really funny. Some of the item names are pretty funny. And you can equip these things into all your different slots, and it changes your exo and can change how your weapons work and how your exo moves and what abilities you have and all this sort of stuff. And it's pretty cool because it's almost a little bit quasi-like the Materia system in Final Fantasy VII, sort of, vaguely. Because instead of having a bunch of items that you're getting in and out, you have slots in a fixed number of items, and you're drastically changing the nature of those items that way. In Final Fantasy VII, of course, you can get different items. Here you don't. Your guns are fixed the whole time until your exo is upgraded at a later point, and then you get some more guns to go with them. But you can change the nature of a gun a lot more here than you can in Final Fantasy. You can add, like, add a spread shot to something, okay. Or, you know, change its range or change its firing characteristics or, you know, things like that. So it's kind of a build your own weapon in some ways.
So I don't know if you've mentioned this, but are the missions themselves randomly generated, or are they, or each mission has like a set design or a set blueprint?
So it's hugely procedural. Okay. The loot is procedural. There's like, I think last count, there's like 180,000 potential pieces of loot you could get. The ratio of the types of missions that are on the city map are always the same. So there's like always, I think it's 8 factory missions, for instance, and so forth. But where they are is completely random. And so as you explore through the city map, the points there are fixed, but where you start is random, where the missions are is random, and how, therefore, everything progresses is random. Mm-hmm. And then once you enter a mission, every factory mission you'll ever play is, you know, really different. Mm-hmm. So those are all procedurally generated. So there's a bunch of different levels of proceduralness.
Okay. Now, you talked a little bit about the weapon system, but is the actual gameplay when you're in the missions, is that real-time, or is that like a turn-based or an I-go-you-go type system?
It's mostly an I-go-you-go type system. So, I mean, it's like most roguelikes. I mean, Dungeons & Dreadmore or whatever. If you walk a space, then enemies get to walk a space. You fire a shot, they get to fire a shot. You know, well, they get to... You take an action, they take an action, really. Okay. So you fire a shot, they move or act. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that you have to attack like the robot arm. You have so many days to do it. So is that sort of like the quote-unquote like the end game, that every game in order to win you have to attack, or are there like other victory conditions?
Actually, what happens is they attack you, and that's the one victory condition. So there's 50 days, it's a countdown, and at the end of those 50 days, if you're still alive, there's an army that's there that's of a certain size. It's been growing the whole game, and you've done different things that you could have done different things to get it smaller. So whatever its size is a result of what you've been doing this whole time. And you have to fight off this army or lose. And if you can take it in multiple goes, so however much health your HQ has left at the end of the game, that's how many chances you get to fight off the army. And you can take them out in parts. So if you defeat a third of the army the first go around and then die, and you've got like 5 health left on your HQ, then you've got another 4 goes to get rid of those remaining 2/3 of the army before, you know, you're just done. Okay. And so that's the end game. You can accelerate things by 5 days instead of 1. Normally each mission is 1 day, but you can accelerate things by 5 days if you attack the robot control centers. And that can be a good idea or a bad idea depending on the actual situation at the time. But so in theory, you could play as few as, I think it's 30 days worth of time. So like 30 floors of a roguelike or 50 floors of one. And there's a lot of emphasis on like serial replayability and so forth too.
Now, speaking about replayability, I know with Skyward, you implemented the sort of metagame system of the profile levels and unlocked new buildings and in return new units. Do you have anything like that in Bionic Dudes or any ways that as you keep playing, more stuff will be unlocked or something like that?
No, we decided not to do that this time because that was, frankly, not that popular with Skyward, with most of the people that got in touch with us. With AI War, we'd had a certain contingent of people asking for that sort of thing, but we never did it with AI War. So we thought we'd try it with Skyward. Then we had a lot of people that were kind of griping about that. So we're just kind of going back to, we're going to do it the AI War way and just have it so you get everything from the start. But there's so much replayability that, you know, the next time you play, you're going to be getting probably items, most of your items being ones that you've never seen before. And, you know, the missions will all be different. And there's also some things like there's all these robot types. And during each mission, only 5 different types show up in that particular mission. So it's not this big soup of guys. Instead, it's just these 5 types. And because of all the different combinations you can have, there's I think it's 870,000 different possible combinations at the moment of how these, just the mixes of enemies that you can fight. And each mix is like a different tactical issue. And so there's replayability there. And then the ones that are for the final battle, it chooses 5 regular types of robots and then 2 boss type robots that are going to be in the final battle. And those ones get extra buffed throughout the game. And so you might see those as being particularly terrifying in one game and being utterly laughable in another game. And that creates a really different feel as well. Because if you've got like a terrifying blunderbot, that's a really different game than playing with a terrifying dumbbot. So that means 2 very different things.
Now, in terms of game length, how long does a typical game of Bionic Dudes last for?
That's really going to depend on the player very, very heavily in terms of exactly how much time they spend customizing their exos for the most part and exactly how much they skip around. The city map, the 3 basic parts of the game are city map in the actual missions and then customizing your exos between missions. The missions themselves largely take mostly on average 5 minutes, maybe, you know, 5 to 10 minutes in general. Some some take a little bit less, some take more like 15 or 20 minutes, but probably the average is somewhere in the 5 to 8 minute range. I haven't timed it exactly, but then the city map, all you do on the city map literally is, you know, click the next mission you want to go to. So it's entirely down to thinking time because which mission you go to next matters. So you're going to be looking at the board, thinking about it, and, you know, doing all that. And I don't really have a good sense for how long people are going to sit there thinking at this point because Keith and I, who are working on it and been doing most of the playtesting and all that, we know the game too well, so we don't have to think very long. So I don't really know how long somebody else would think. There's also a store that you can buy stuff with credits that you get off enemies. So there is that on this, when you're back at the city map. So you can get some like epic loot that way. And then there's, you know, the customization side of it. You know, you pick up new parts through every mission. Then, you know, where do you put those parts? Do you swap out old stuff? Which of the four exos do you put the stuff in? Yada, yada. And my guess there is that people could spend anywhere from 2 to 20 minutes per mission, you know, depending on how OCD they are. And it's really going to depend on what sort of loot you get there too. You know, what loot do you sell for credits? What loot do you, you know, buy in the store? You can put stuff on layaway in the store and then get it later. And, you know, so those are three main parts. Overall averages, I think you could probably, if you're a real advanced player, finish it in 3 to 5 hours. If you, a single game of it, if you're playing for the first time, I think you're probably going to be looking more like 8 to 12 hours. If you're really contemplative or really OCD about the parts, you could be looking at 16 to 20 hours. So, I mean, 3 to 20 hours, I mean, that's an enormous spread, right? So it's really going to depend on the player and what they're bringing to it and how they want to play it.
All right. Now, in terms of difficulty, you talk about how players can alter the difficulty of the game. What kind of variables are you looking at for the game?
So there's a difficulty level you can select, just like with all of our games. When you select the lower difficulties, that changes how fast the bots level up. It changes how fast the production rate of bots show up, so how many exactly you're facing and which bots you're facing in larger numbers. And it adjusts how good of parts you're finding, so it adjusts your power level indirectly that way as well. It's the manufacturing level and the scavenging level and the bot level up rate. And there's a fourth factor that I'm forgetting at this point, but yeah.
All right, and we're just about going to wrap up here. One other question I have is, I know with a lot of your games from Ark, and you have a multiplayer component. Does Bionic Deuce have any kind of multiplayer mode, or is it strictly a single player?
Yeah, yep. All of our games have co-op multiplayer. The only one that's not online is Shattered Haven, and it's probably going to remain our only one that doesn't, just because it was our oldest one in terms of when the engine was first developed. But so at any rate, this has online multiplayer. And what happens with that? Normally, you play with one exo, one mech, and you have four in your roster, but only one active at a time. And you switch which one is out on the board by clicking its profile or hitting like the six through nine keys. And that is how you normally play. In multiplayer, if you've got a second person, then they have an exo out, you have an exo out, and you can switch between the ones that you aren't selected. So you're not locked into one. If you're playing with the siege guy and I'm playing with the assault guy, if you switch to sniper, I could take the siege guy, and we just swap around however we want to. And so you can play with up to four people because there's four exos. And then, you know, if you've got four people, there's no room to swap, so you're stuck. But at any rate, yeah, so then you've got more exos walking around than usual, which makes it pretty different. The IACT, UACT thing is something that a lot of roguelikes have really struggled to solve in multiplayer. And the way that we've dealt with that is making it so that, you know, if there's no enemies around in particular, you can just move perfectly fluidly. If there's enemies around, then, of course, you're kind of going into battle mode, and you want to be not wandering long ways, you know, really quickly. And we've made it so that if I'm over on one side of the map and I'm getting into a fight situation, you're on the other side of the map and you just want to walk around. Normally, if you were walking around and causing enemies on my side to take actions and shoot and kill me, that would be making me pretty mad at you. It's like, stop walking. You're like, man, he's fighting again. I've got to, like, not walk because he's fighting. That's lame. So based on the proximity of you to me and the fight that I'm having, if you're not actually over and involved in the fight, then you can just walk around and it doesn't affect my guys at all, the guys that are near me. If you and I are both in the fight, then I act, they take an action, you act, they take an action, and so forth. And so it balances itself out there. It's the I act, you act sort of thing is always going to be very mildly awkward if you're trying to, like, run around pretending it's a real-time thing. When there's enemies about, but usually when there's enemies about, you're going to want to sit, you know, you're going to want to take a move, quickly size up what it is you're doing, you know, take a shot, you know, look at the new situation, take another shot or move, you know, and you're not just like running. Because if you're running, you're dying. So it should work out pretty well. In our testing, we've really liked it. We had to work pretty hard to get that working sensibly at all, because most roguelikes don't have multiplayer for a reason. But I think we've gotten that done about as well as could possibly be done in that genre, so we're pleased.
Yeah, but definitely sounds like a great compromise to the iGo-UGO system. With Bionic Deuce, is it going to be just like a local? Is it going to be like peer-to-peer online or server-based?
It's peer-to-peer, so you can play on the LAN or internet or whatever. So it's just like Skyward, basically, or AI War, or Tidalis.
All right. I think that is about it. I got one last question. Ken, do you have any questions you would like to ask Chris about Bionic?
No, that sounds pretty cool.
Thanks.
All right. So I guess the last question then is, when are you looking to have the game release?
That'll be mid-October. So we're looking at starting our private alpha with select couple dozen players next week. We'll be not quite feature complete, but pretty close to feature complete by the end of this week. We'll be doing most of the other features are kind of more cosmetic or added content coming throughout the rest of September. And we'll be doing like a public beta starting in 2-3 weeks, something like that. And then running the public beta for a little while until we hit the release date in mid-October. So,
all right, cool.
Coming up quick.
Yeah. Okay, I think with that, we're going to wrap things up. Chris, it was great to have you on again. And
Yeah, thanks.
And I can't wait to see what else you guys are playing with Skyward, and I can't wait to try out Bionic Dudes next month.
All right, well, I appreciate it. I'm always happy to come on, so thanks for having me back.
No problem. And Ken, as always, it was great to have you on.
No problem.
And
yeah, definitely.
All right, and with that said, we're going to end things here. As always, if you're interested in either writing a piece for the site or being a future guest on the cast, you can send us an email via the Submissions Wanted link. That will take you to the page where you can see what we're looking for in terms of writing, and feel free to send us an email at any time. So, with that said, thank you for tuning into the Perceptive Podcast this week. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next week. Take care, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.